And tonight, our main speaker is Patrick.
My name is Patrick. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Sunday Night Big Book in Orleans, Ontario, Canada, which is just about a half an hour east of Ottawa. My sobriety date is the 13th of September, 1992. I have a sponsor, and I'm involved in active sponsorship of young men. So I have to tell you, it's a real privilege to attend a meeting at the Atlantic Group, or any meeting for that matter that's based on structure and tradition and good sponsorship, etc. And it's a privileged responsibility to be allowed to stand at your podium. So thank you. Thank you, Nye, for asking me. You know, thanks, Val, and thanks, Justin. I could relate to a lot of what you spoke about there. As I certainly, the details of my upbringing might have been a little different, but I think the undercurrent was the same. And I grew up in Ireland, in Dublin, Ireland. I'm from Dublin originally, in a very average working-class home. No alcohol, no active alcoholism in our home. No, there wasn't. There wasn't. My father was a two-drink type of guy. I used to hate drinking with the guy because he would nurse that second drink. It didn't matter how long you were going to be there. He'd nurse that drink to last, that second drink. His brother Tommy was a different story. He could drink anybody under the table. But I don't think Tommy was an alcoholic because Tommy... Now, Tommy never missed work, never let anybody down, never hurt anybody. Tommy just liked to drink. But I don't believe he's an alcoholic. He didn't seem to have the same problems that alcoholics have. My mother's family, however, was just riddled with active alcoholism. And I think for that reason, my mother just never took the plug out of the jug, so she never could put the plug back in the jug. But she certainly had some of the isms. And I used to say that my mother celebrated 90 years of sobriety and 91 years of sobriety because she never drank. But last year, somebody in the nursing home, she had dementia, handed her a sherry on St. Patrick's Day, so I guess she had a slip. You know. She just died this February, short of a year sober. Yeah. But, you know, as I say, that was the home I grew up in, and I don't know why I grew up as a really anxious young kid. I don't know why I grew up not feeling I belonged, not feeling I fit in. I don't know why that was. I grew up in an Irish family that didn't do emotion very well, didn't express emotion very well. You can relate to that. The three R's of an Irish education: reading, writing, and guilt. So you threw me there now. They didn't do emotion very well. And they... feelings weren't spoken about. But I don't think that's what made me an alcoholic. There was just something about me. And really, when I got to be sober for a few years and have children with my wife, Linda, we were out. I was out, actually. I used to take care of our firstborn child out to the big park in Montreal and take her out to feed the squirrels, shuffle through the leaves. And she'd be in her little one-piece suit, you know, a two-year-old, just shuffling along like the Michelin Man or Neil Armstrong, First Steps on the Moon. Through the leaves, you know, totally, totally enamored of this world. And it was like she didn't know where she ended and where the world began. And looking at her, I started, well, actually a little later, not too long after that, this other little girl came along and wanted to feed the squirrels. So now Kira's wanted to bring almonds instead of peanuts and hip-check that little girl out of the way. And I guess what happened, what I saw happening with my own daughter, was when words like mine and yours and me and you and them and us start to come in. Language. For some reason, when I got introduced to that type of language, I started comparing myself to other people. And I don't know about you, but I never came up on the right side of a comparison. Today, I'm not even sure if there is the right side of a comparison. But I never came up on the top side of the comparison. One of my daughters got a thing sent to her on Facebook. And it was a picture of this guy, and he's naked, and it's from the back. And in front of him is this massive big elephant. And the caption is the elephant speaking, saying, "How do you breathe through that thing? What has that got to do with me?" Simply, I don't know, I really knew what I was comparing until I was sober for a few years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was looking at a lot of other people, observing a lot of other people, and I was trying to be like them, as was most of my life. As a young boy, I just couldn't deal with reality. As a young boy, I had three strategies not to deal with reality. Because my presumption before I walked out the door was, they're not going to like me. For some reason, that's the way I was. And how I dealt with that was, I just didn't come out. I became a recluse. Or alternatively, I put on the mask, I became a pretender, put on the brave face. And I think a lot of us become pretenders. And I'd like to tell you that I stopped being a pretender when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, but it took quite a few years for me to stop being a pretender. And the other thing I did, the other strategy, was I just would find a distraction. I'm sorry, my mouth's very dry. I had laryngitis last week, so just bear with me. But that was me, and I didn't feel like I belonged in the family. I really thought, you know, I was from somewhere else. That was to stay with me right through my teenage and into my adulthood. I mean, I felt like the outsider on the street. I felt like the outsider at school, on my soccer team. Even in a relationship, I felt like the outsider. Like, there's only two people. Why I was the outsider and she wasn't, I don't know. But I felt like the outsider. And that's the way that was. Until I got to 12 years of age, and I started to work in a pub near Dublin Airport. And I fell in love with what these people had. You know, the Mayflower Hotel is coming up as a trip for you guys. When they talk about that chatter, that camaraderie, that sense that's just swimming out of the bar, the music, you know, on the waves, you know, that sort of sense of camaraderie and comfort and ease, I fell in love with that watching these people in this bar in Dublin. I fell in love with what they seemed to have. I wanted it. What they had was they were able to express emotion. They were able to be just okay with each other. They looked forward to seeing each other. They sang, they laughed, they were happy. And I wanted some of what they had, and I was prepared to take steps to get it. And I took steps into the stockroom, and I started to prize open a few bottles, and I started to drink. And shortly after that, I was in a blackout at a school dance. And I went to a school. We had a Christian brother around our school, and he was a big man. He had a massive big round head on huge industrial shoulders and no neck. We used to call him Joe Moon. And I'd find myself outside the class for misbehavior often enough. And when he'd walk down the corridor, he blocked out the light. And I think that's why he got the name Joe Moon. He'd had it before I got there, but it was like a total eclipse as he came down that corridor. So I was at a blackout at the school dance, and this brother didn't like my rendition of Mick Jagger's Satisfaction on the dance floor. And I didn't like his criticism. And I asked him out into the schoolyard to sort this out in a manly way, fists up. And back then, I was skinnier then than I am now. I mean, if I didn't turn sideways and stick out my tongue, I'd get marked absent. And I'm going to take on this heavyweight. That's not alcoholic insanity. That's just being so drunk you're in a blackout and you don't know what's going on. And I was a blackout drinker from the beginning. Right from the beginning of my drinking. And through my teenage years, I probably backed out 6-7 times a year. Later teenage, it got more frequent. Near the end, I almost always blacked out. Almost always. Near the end, my blackouts changed a little bit, and I'd become very conscious of the space that was just immediately in front of me. And if you were in that space, that was fine. But if you weren't, I didn't have a clue what was going on. You know, after the blackout at the school dance, my friends told me the next morning what had happened, and I thought they were just yanking my chain. That couldn't possibly be me. But word came down from the school that I should go up there over the weekend and make an account of myself, because the brothers lived at the school. And I went up there, and the brother basically corroborated what my friends had told me had happened the night before. And all I can tell you is over the next 21 years of drinking, what happened got worse and worse, and the intervals between what happened got less and less. And I was on my way. But I never thought much about drinking. You know, I didn't like the jackpots I get into, but in Ireland, everybody seemed to be drinking that way. At least I thought they were drinking that way. And it's a big drinking culture, as a lot of people here probably know. There's a story of the Irish guy who goes to the doctor. He's a hypochondriac, and he's always asking the doctor to find out what's wrong. And finally, the doctor, in total exasperation, said, "You know what? I've examined you for everything imaginable, and I just can't find anything that's wrong with you. It must be the drink." He said, "Okay, doctor, I'll come back someday when you're not drinking." And that kind of was Ireland, you know. So those blackouts led me on some magical mystery tours. I remember being at an off-Broadway play down in Greenwich Village and ended up in Times Square. No idea how I got there. My jacket was on the back of a chair in a bar, at the bar area. And I could start drinking in Montreal, wake up here in New York. I'd wake up in the darndest of places. Wake up and wonder, who are all these people? Why are we all in bed together? And then I'm trying to sneak out of bed or sneak out of the apartment, wherever I was. And I'm looking in a drawer for an invoice or a phone bill or something so I can find an address, because it's a little difficult to call the dispatcher and say, where would you like us to send the cab? Well, I don't know. Didn't have GPS in those days, on the phone. And anyway, I might have only been around the corner from where I live, so why take a taxi? But that's the way it was. I never really knew what was going to happen. Like a lot of blackout drinkers, I don't remember a lot of what happened to me, and a lot of what happened to me, I don't remember. And a lot of what I think I remember probably never happened. And by blackout, I really mean that, to be absolutely operational for hours and usually creating havoc, and then no recollection of it at all after that. And that's just the way my life went on. I started my geographicals quickly. I left Dublin. I went to Western Canada, to Winnipeg, then Los Angeles, then back to Winnipeg and Edmonton, then Toronto, then Montreal, all in 6 years. I did those geographicals. And that gets expensive when you get around to doing your ninth step, because I had to go on tour. And I've made amends in all those places. So. But when I left home, when I was living at home in Ireland, when I left home, really I could just drink as I wanted to, do what I wanted to, whenever I wanted to. And that's what I did. I was fairly successful. I had 6 jobs in Winnipeg, all with the same employer. I was fired or I quit 3 times each. And to a lot of people, I was a functioning alcoholic. But given the money I was earning, I didn't have a red cent. I couldn't drink at all. I didn't have any drug problems to get rid of my money. I didn't have a gambling addiction. I think I must have stood in the corner like, Father Christmas and handed out money, or just in a blackout buy the whole bar a drink or something. Anyway, I'm not going to stay in the drunkalogue too long. I went through a lot of good jobs, a lot of good cities, a lot of good relationships. But it's pretty difficult to settle for something when you don't know what you're looking for. And I never knew what I was looking for, because I'd become very adept at observing all you people. I'd become very adept at trying to fit in. I had a lot of, a cartoon I saw once, I think it was Larson. It was BC. And it's this guy lying on a rock, on a horizontal rock. And beside him is a guy sitting on a rock, a psychiatrist, and he's taking notes. And he says, when did you first suspect you might suffer from multiple personality disorder? And the patient said, I think it was when I realized I was the only person in my group therapy. And I didn't have multiple personality disorder. That's something different. But I had a lot of personalities, because I tried to fit in a lot of places, and I never fit in. Because what I was doing, and I didn't realize it till way into sobriety, was I was observing what was going on outside me. I wasn't observing what was going on inside me. Today I try and observe what's going on inside me all the time, if I can. And although I could fit in like a chameleon into situations, I never felt like I fit in. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that life is what happens inside me. It's not what happens outside of me. That's probably the biggest thing I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyways, take you through those geographicals. I ended up in Montreal. I ended up like a lot of people. I ended up in total isolation. Basically, alcoholism had taken all the people out of my life. I wasn't in touch with my friends I grew up with. I stopped being in touch with my family in Ireland. I didn't really have any friends left in Montreal, because they were drinking at different pace than me, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I liked to go down the east end of Montreal and get drunk down there, because I wouldn't run into a client. And I was really living in the woman I'd been living with had just upped sticks and moved to Kingston, Ontario to start a new life for herself. I'd met her in Toronto. And she followed me to Montreal. She was like the Mounties. She was going to get her man. And she did. And she got more than her man for her trouble. I was never physically abusive of Linda, but I sure led her a merry dance. God bless her. But she tracked me down, and then she moved away. And when she moved away, and I had 11 business partners in Canada with a fairly successful company, I hadn't had a meaningful conversation with any one of those guys in a year and a half. And that's where alcoholism brought me to. For a guy who always wanted to belong, and I believe that's one of the deepest instincts and desires in most human beings. Alcoholism, which promised me, the only time I felt I belonged really was if I was under the influence. But alcoholism left me totally, completely isolated. I started to get very, I tried all kinds of things. I tried psychiatry, I tried religion, I tried yoga, meditation. I tried just about everything to try and deal with my problems, but still pouring weed killer on, on anything. I thought it was growing. Finally, anyway, I arrived at a situation where I just knew the gig was up. I was starting to have DTs, you know. Actually, just on that, recently I was reading of a British surgeon in India during the wars in India who actually thought with the Irish contingent in the British Army that their belief in the leprechauns was a manifestation of the DTs. So could possibly be true. But more than anything else, I felt I was augering down into madness, just augering down into madness, just corkscrewing into the ground. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous out of cowardice. I'd met people from Alcoholics Anonymous over the years. After that first school dance when I blacked out, the head brother brought somebody in from public information in Dublin, and he told a story at the front of the art class, and I was put sitting in the front seat. And I couldn't relate to him. I kind of thought, what an unlucky, misfortunate, miserable, wretched, down-on-his-luck type of guy. But I could not relate to him at all. And then we had a neighbor, Dorothy, and Dorothy asked me that I not think there was something bizarre about my drinking in my mid-teens. And I thought there was something bizarre about Dorothy. And then in Winnipeg, in Nipawin, Manitoba, there was a man there. He was a bastion of Alcoholics Anonymous in Nipawin, Manitoba, Bud. And Bud asked me the same thing. But all that just fell on deaf ears. But here I was, totally alone in the world, thinking I was going mad, thinking one of three things is going to happen here. Somebody's going to take me down a back lane and just do a little bit of bloodletting, you know, save on the paperwork, because I'd become a real public nuisance. Or alternatively, I'm just going to go nuts. And if it's not that, I'm going to end up in the joint. And I was a baby-faced kid with blonde hair. I did not want to end up in the joint. That's for sure. So cowardice got me here, and I'm thankful for that cowardice. I didn't see the light, and I didn't feel the heat. There was nobody left in my life to turn up the heat, to be perfectly frank. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I met the man who was to become my sponsor at my first meeting. A woman shook my hand at the door, Dorothy S. in Montreal. And when she found out it was my first meeting, she said, "Let me find a man for you." She introduced me to Les. And Les basically took me under his wing. And I'd like to tell you from there on in, you know, because of rooms like this and people like you, Goldilocks got invited back for seconds and everybody lived happily ever after. But it wasn't like that. Les did a lot of one-on-one work with me. We'd meet at his kitchen table twice a week. Or we'd meet at this little diner near where he worked. And Les would tell me what was going on in his life, and he would tell me what happened to him. Les didn't tell me what to do. I had Les for 3.5 years, and he basically gave me everything I needed to have. 3.5 years into my sobriety, Les and my little sister died in the space of a few months. And on Les's last operation, walking down the corridor as he was being pushed on the gurney, holding onto his hand with his medallion in his hand, he said to me, "You know, if you forget everything else I ever spoke to you about, don't forget this. 99.9% of everything I ever worried about never happened." It was like that was the biggest learning of his life. Anyway, and that was important for me because fear played a huge part in my drinking and actually in my recovery too. Anyway, I was a year and a half in Alcoholics Anonymous, hanging on to people's shirt tails like Les, following in their wake. I was told stick with the winners. I was told, you know, being in early sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous is like waking up in a minefield. Follow the guys who don't blow up. And so I was following the guys who didn't blow up. But I got to a point, I was asked to speak in Montreal one Thursday night, and I got to the point where I just wouldn't want to be there. I didn't want to be there that night. I'd learned to talk the talk, but I hadn't learned to walk the walk. And I felt like a phony, and I felt like a fraud. And I experienced a loneliness in Alcoholics Anonymous that was beyond any loneliness I've ever experienced in my life before or since. I thought I had done my steps. I'd skipped through them. You know, I'd skipped through them at last. I was stuck on that dash in the middle of the first step. I hadn't really seen that my life was unmanageable. I was going to, you know, big book weekends, and I was going to study meetings and whatever. It seemed to escape me that although the problem was my life was unmanageable, I seemed to want to get all this information from you people and manage my life. I seemed to think if I could just glean from you the recipe and the formula for this, I could go and fix myself in the privacy of my own home, never have to expose my warts and all to the world. And it wasn't to be that way. Where that led me to was wanting to jump off the bridge in Montreal. So I had to get down to causes and conditions, and I had to go back and look at my steps again. And my steps the second time around went very fast. And my fourth step, and growing up an Irish Catholic, I always looked at the fourth and fifth step as being sort of confessional in nature. And I realized they were educational in nature. And I realized that the chapter How It Works really tells us how it doesn't work. And I realized that all I had to do was look at three things: my resentments, which is my perception of not having gotten my way in the past. And my fears, which were my worries that I wouldn't get my way in the future, 5 minutes from now, 5 years from now, whatever. And my wrongdoings, which were the things that I did in order to try and get what I wanted that I didn't think life would deliver. And I only lied to you because I didn't think you'd accept me as I was. And I only stole because I didn't think the world and its bounty would take care of me. And so I looked at that a whole different way. And in my fourth and fifth step, I also realized I'd written off everybody in the world. There were the people who seemed to always know what they were doing, and they intimidated me, and they made me feel inferior. And so I wrote them off, and I assassinated their characters. And then on the other side, there was the people that in my perception were worse off than me. They may not have been, but in my perception. And I didn't want anything to do with them, guilt by association. And then I wondered why I was lonely in the middle. And I think loneliness and isolation, to me, is the hallmark of alcoholism, where it leaves us. And the only antidote to it is identification. The only antidote to isolation, I think, is identification. I realized when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time that the third step, the first step is an admission, but it's not a surrender. And the second step is a belief, a state of belief, but it's not a surrender. And the third step is a decision, but it's not a surrender. The surrendering only began for me when I started to level with another human being. But when I got through my fifth step, really, at that stage, I just knew where I was. I knew what was wrong. It's like going to the hospital and the triage nurse and the doctor see you and tell you what's wrong. So after step five, I'm at the beginning. You know, I just know what's wrong. Now I've got to try and do something about it. And in six and seven, the second time around, I realized that was trying to put into real time what I'd learned from my fourth and fifth step with my sponsor. And that's not so easy. And I'd like to tell you I have that down pat, but I don't. You know, last year, I had lunch with a sponsee, and the two of us came out of the restaurant on a spiritual hovercraft. We just... And I went across the street, and this guy in a red... I was a little late, I grant you that. I was a little late crossing the street, and this guy in a red Camaro came screaming down the street. And I won't... This is the Atlantic Group, so I won't repeat what he said to me. It wasn't very nice. And quicker than an athlete on steroids, I was back out in the middle of the street giving him sign language. And that's where my serenity was. Because I think the big challenge for us, it's easy when you're with your sponsor. It's like being with your coach, and the coach says, you see, you got out of position, and bing, bang, boom, the ball was in the back of the net. Well, that's easy when you got a chalkboard in 20 minutes to explain it, but when it's all happening in milliseconds, it's a little different. And so I've realized that for me, the big challenge in my life, in applying the steps in my life on a daily basis, is trying to find that space between the stimulus and the response. And that's the pause they talk about in the 10th and the 11th step. When agitated, we pause. The art of the pause. You know, and I have to do that. The 8th and 9th step, I'd like to tell you, I went off running doing those. It was a couple of those steps I didn't want, a couple of amends I didn't want to make. And basically, anything I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've become willing to do through my experience of being unwilling to do it. And when being unwilling to do it became painful enough, I actually did it. And in my case, I had a lot of people offer to take away my pain very easily, the stroke of a pen. And in my case, I'm glad I didn't go down that road, because pain has been a very important part of my recovery. The only reason I know that what you people told me was the truth was because it was the only thing that dissolved my pain. Nothing else ever dissolved my pain. Nothing else ever made me feel like I belonged. And if I had gotten rid of that pain by artificial means, I wouldn't have had that barometer, that acid test, to know that what you people were speaking about was the truth. I made my final amend in 2000 in Port Credit, Ontario. I flew across the Atlantic to see a guy, one of my ex-business partners, and I made amends with him at 6 in the morning. He told me it was the only time he could see me before he went to play golf. All I can tell you is that there was a vein of sobriety opened up to me after making that last amend that wasn't there before. My first sponsor was of the Hebrew faith, and he used to tell me that on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, we try to become at one with God. But he told me there's no point trying to become at one with God unless you're at one with your fellow human being. That you can't build a faith life on a faulty moral foundation. Step 10, 11, and 12, 10 and 11, as I say, I mean, that's the only thing that keeps me going now. I mean, I don't multitask well. I actually can't meditate and have a resentment at the same time. I can't keep the line open to my higher power and have a resentment at the same time. I don't do that very well at all. The 12th step, to me, is just wonderful. You know, to have the privilege of the before, particularly with a guy who's coming in new, and you see the before and after washing powder commercial of this guy. You know, you see what he was like before, you see what he was like afterwards. And to watch the smiles come back on his children's faces, or his parents' faces. It's unbelievable. We have a show, we have a seat at the greatest show on earth. And I think it's in doing that we really understand the power of this program. Because the power of this program, the spirit of this program, moves through these rooms invisibly. But we're the people that it touches. And the only time we get to witness it or evidence it is when it touches us. And so today I realize I need 12-step work because the first 9 steps extricated me from the wreckage of the past. The back 3 steps keep me out of the fear and projection and worry of the future. And with 12-step work, I don't forget what happened to me. Because I could always forget. And when those 3 things are in place, I find myself in the now. No credit to me. I just find myself in the now by getting myself out of the past and getting myself out of the future. By deduction, I'm here and here and now. And what I've learned, I used to think that a spiritual experience was the destination of the 12 steps. And now I realize it's only the beginning, one more time. Because when we have that spiritual experience, our job is to become transmitters and retransmit that experience to others. And only in giving it away can we keep it. Thank you very much.